Well, good evening, everybody, and welcome to this evening's event. It's called Let's Talk Finances. It's great to have you here, and I'd invite you, if you feel a little bit far away, to come even closer, especially once we get to do some work on the whiteboard. You might find it hard to see if you're too far away. Now, the background behind this evening's meeting is that back in August, we had a men's camp. And a bunch of people went away, and our theme was half-time. And most of the men who were on the camp were probably 40 plus. And so we were talking about, that's 40 years plus. So we're talking about living our lives for God and giving, you know, of our wisdom and our experience into serving God and living our lives for Him more intentionally. And one of the things that we realised is, you know, and we'd realised this before the camp, but one of the things that many Christians struggle with is that I want to serve God. I want to have a commitment to His kingdom and to living for Him. But I happen to also live in a very expensive city, and you know, I'm trying to put away money to retire on and to make sure that I'm not a burden to my children, et cetera, et cetera. And so often what happens is we find ourselves struggling with the question of how do I kind of be a good steward of what God's given me, and how much is enough? And the problem is that you could go to just about any secular financial advisor and they're not going to tell you, hey, you know, you could really afford to stop working now, and you could afford to stop saving, and maybe you could do some other things with your life that would be really beneficial for the world out there and would benefit God's kingdom. There's not very many financial advisors going to tell you that. So tonight, what we thought we'd do is get a couple of guys to actually have a conversation with us. So they're going to present, but we're also going to have plenty of time for questions and answers. And we're hoping that they can help us do some work around what does it mean to be a steward, and even to get a sense of some objectivity around that. Now, it's going to be a different set of answers for all of us in the room because we all have different circumstances. So there's no one line that we can draw on the board that's going to be true for all of us, or maybe there is. But I think what we're hoping is that through this, we'll be able to have a conversation that will give us some clarity. And my hope and my prayer is that out of tonight will come a sense of freedom from people around how they might be able to use their time, use their resources, both in looking after themselves, but also in serving God and serving His kingdom. Tonight's speakers, we have John Altman's going to speak to us first. John's been a friend of mine for a number of years and was a catalyst in my family and I going to Tanzania. John is a commercial lawyer. He's been an Anglican minister, and he's also a social entrepreneur. And he provides legal services for setting up charitable organisations, for commercial enterprises, and for individuals who are planning for generosity. So John's going to speak to us first this evening. And then our second speaker tonight is Hayden Bernow. Hayden is an actuary who leads a business called Causeway. It's a small company seeking to boost cause thinking and outcomes in the corporate and social sectors and for individuals. So why don't we welcome these guys? It's good to have you. And I might just open with a quick prayer. Cool. Let's pray. Father God, we just thank You for the way that You bless us. We thank You that You provide for our needs so generously. We thank You that You give us, and then You ask us to be stewards of those gifts and to be wise stewards of all the resources that we have. And we pray tonight that You would help us through these two speakers to gain some clarity and some wisdom and some insight about how we can better serve You with the resources that You've given us. We thank You and pray that You will bless us now in Jesus' name. Amen.
Andrew did tell me that I was coming to a small, intimate gathering of men. I feel rather conned. Nevertheless, it's really nice to be here. It's nice to see you. If you want to move forward, feel free. If you sit right at the back, you probably won't feel like asking a question. Or maybe Wei Han will. He's sitting up the back like a good Anglican. I don't know. Anyway, I'm hoping that you'll interrupt and ask questions. So if you want to stick your hand up and ask at any stage, do. You don't even have to stick your hand up. Just shout something out. It'll be much more interesting than listening to me all night. Now, as Andrew said, I'm an ordained Anglican for my sins, but I've gone over to the dark side and gone back to practice law. You know why it's not a good thing to kind of stack up a lot of Anglican ministers in one place, kind of heap them up? Because they kind of smell bad. But if you spread them out, sometimes they the further out you spread them, the better they do. But that's not nearly as bad as lawyers, because you know they've taken to burying lawyers 12 feet deep in specially marked graves. You know why? Because deep down they're really good guys. But even better, we have in our midst this evening a practicing actuary who's going to draw lots of complicated graphs and use PowerPoint and befuddle you, I'm sure. I hate PowerPoint, so he got the PowerPoint. I just got a piece of paper. But I've got to tell you my favourite actuary joke. I've probably told Hayden this before, and he's a dear friend, so he probably won't take offence. Do you know what the difference between an introverted and an extroverted actuary is? An introverted actuary looks at his shoes while he's talking to you, but the extroverted actuary looks at your shoes while he's talking to you. Nevertheless, I think Hayden is going to look at you and smile this evening. Well, what I wanted to do is go through this handout and just give you a brief biblical overview of our stewardship. Now, I don't think I'm going to be teaching you anything that you probably haven't heard before lots of times in church. We're just going to refresh our memory. And if anyone's got a Bible, they might refresh my voice by reading out some of these verses for me, if you want to look one of them up. You'll remember, won't you, that the Bible starts in Genesis chapter 1 with humanity being given what? Stewardship, dominion over all the creatures of the earth, everything that there is. And the man and the woman are put in the garden to, can you remember the words? Tend, someone said, till, old-fashioned, till and keep it, to make use of the world, to be God's representatives in the world, to look after it, but given it by God and given a really high place in it. What about Psalm 24, verse 1? Someone must remember what that says, whether you've got a Bible in your hand or not. The earth is the Lord's and the fullness thereof, everything in it, the NIV says. What about Psalm 49, verse 16? If someone wants to read it out before I get there, that's a sobering reminder, isn't it? We brought nothing into the world, Job says, and we can take nothing out of it either. And people who grow rich, well, they're going to die and perish nevertheless. Or what about you'll remember when God brings his people into the good land that he wants to give them in Israel. He has this to say to them. Now, isn't that a very relevant text for us today, who have enormous ability to produce wealth in the good earth that God has given us, but very, very easy to forget that it came from God, and the ability and the strength to produce things came from him. Or what about 1 Chronicles chapter 29 verses 1 to 10? This is about the offering that David takes up to build the temple that Solomon is going to build. And I don't know if you remember the story, but it's very interesting. He said he makes an offering out of his own, well, out of official kind of Israelite property. And then he says, oh, and I've given this other amount of gold and silver out of my own personal possessions. And then he challenges the leaders of Israel to do the same, to make an offering. And can you remember what he says? Can you remember what he says about that? They're to make an offering, but the way he phrases is really interesting. He asks, who is willing to, can anyone remember? Consecrate themselves to the Lord today. So they're going to make an offering of things that they have for the building of this temple that God's instructed them to build. But first, what David challenges them to do is to actually consecrate themselves to the Lord. So they're to give all of themselves, aren't they? It's not just their piece of gold or silver, but all of themselves, and out of that, the gold and silver as a token of that offering. That's a pretty interesting picture that I think is pretty relevant to us, has ongoing relevance to us. Well, let me read you some of one of my favourite chapters of the Old Testament for people who like doing things, buying and selling things. These are great verses. This is a picture that you'll remember, a picture of the kind of ideal wife, a very wise person who's thought about how to conduct their lives. And some of this is really interesting. So this woman, she selects wool and flax and works with eager hands. And then in verse 16, she considers a field and buys it. Out of her earnings, she plants a vineyard. She sets about her work vigorously, and her arms are strong for her task. Or, in her hands, she holds the spindle and grasps it with her fingers, and she opens her arms to the poor and extends her hands to the needy. Can you see what's going on? What does she do with her hands? She makes money with her hands and she gives it away. She extends her hands to the needy in her community. She's a kind of exemplary Old Testament Israelite, I think. She's got on her heart God's concern for the needy at the edges of the community who are vulnerable, and she helps them. But she makes things herself and creates wealth out of what God has given in the good land to provide for that. Now, this has got really interesting echoes in the New Testament. Does anyone know what Ephesians 4:28 says off the top of their heads? People who've been stealing must steal no longer. That's probably the bit you remember. Can you remember the next part of the verse? But instead, what are they to do? Do something useful with their hands, or work hard with their hands so that they have something to share with those in need. Now, doesn't that sound a little bit like this woman from the Old Testament? It's a pretty interesting echo, I think, of how we use what we've been given. Of course, in the New Testament, there's a heap of stuff about wealth. I think someone said that Jesus probably had more to say about money and wealth than just about nearly any other topic. I don't know if that's true or not. And you know, you'd be pretty familiar with quite a lot of this. So, Luke chapter 12, the parable of the rich fool. Be on your guard against all kinds of greed, because life doesn't consist in abundance of possessions. And he told them this parable. The ground of a certain rich man yielded an abundant harvest, and he thought to himself, "What shall I do? I have no place to store my crops." Then he said, "This is what I'll do. I will tear down my barns and build bigger ones, and there I will store my surplus grain. And I'll say to myself, you have plenty of grain laid up for many years. Take life easy, eat, drink, and be merry." But God said to him, "You fool, this very night your life will be demanded from you. Who then will get what you have prepared for yourself?" This is how it will be with those who store up things for themselves but are not rich towards God. Did you hear the echo of Psalm 49 in that? Interesting, isn't it? You can't take it with you. And what did the rich man in this story do wrong? What was kind of echoed over and over again in the way the story is told? It's all his, isn't it? It's I, my. I'm going to do this and I'm going to do that and it's all mine. I think he just hadn't got it, even vaguely got it from the Old Testament that the earth is the Lord's and everything in it. Or from 1 John chapter 3, verse 16 and so on, you'd be familiar with these verses as well, that we need to love in truth and action, and we can't do that if we ignore basically people around us who we see in need. So let us, you know, dear children, let us love not just in words, but in real actions. And this last text that I want to draw your attention to in this sort of whirlwind tour through the Bible is from 1 Timothy chapter 6. And I pick this one because I think that this is actually probably the most general and generic summary applicable to us all today as Christians about what to do with wealth and with money. So Paul says to Timothy that he is to command those who are rich in this present world not to be arrogant nor to put their hope in wealth, but to put their hope in God, who richly provides us with everything for our enjoyment, and command them to do good, to be rich in good deeds, and to be generous and willing to share. In this way, they will lay up treasure for themselves as a firm foundation for the coming age, so that they may take hold of the life that is truly life. Now, that contains a summary of a lot of the themes that we've just kind of rushed through, doesn't it? The God who richly provides us with everything for our enjoyment, and what we are to do is to do good, to be rich in good deeds, and to be generous and willing to share. So there's a universal standard for Christians, universally applicable, to be generous and willing to share. And picking up on Jesus' teaching in that way, to lay up treasure in heaven, in the life to come, to look forward, not just to now and what you've got now. Well, I don't think I've kind of told you anything you probably don't know. How do you think we're going to put this into practice? John Wesley said, I think helpfully, this is maybe getting some contours for what we might think about, that Christians, or that we should earn all you can, save all you can, and give all you can. That's probably pretty good advice, sums up lots of the kind of themes from the Bible that we've been looking at. Of course, it doesn't tell you what to do in your situation, does it? But there's maybe some principles behind that that we could start to think about some more. That you might, if that's your approach, you would actually plan things. You would plan to give. So I don't think generosity can be linked just to spontaneous responses, because you think about it, you know, you've got a lifetime, you've got lots of years to be responsible with. You've got more than just money, haven't you? You've got things to consecrate to God, to offer, involving time and the abilities and other things you've been given, not just money. So there's a lot to be responsible. There's a lot to plan for, isn't there? If you take Wesley's advice, you'd have to think seriously about how we might limit our lifestyle deliberately with some kind of modesty. So he earned more and more as his life went on, from royalties, from book sales. I don't know if you can do that now, unless you're a kind of best-selling author of something lewd on Kindle, you probably don't earn much out of books, but he earned an absolute packet in his day out of people reading his books. But he maintained his lifestyle pretty much the same level right through his life. There's all his journals and budgets. He was a bit of a... He was probably an actuary before his time, actually. He liked budgeting. And there wasn't high inflation. So at the end of his life, when you see what he spent, it was pretty close to what he spent 20, 30 years ago. That's interesting, isn't it? How do we... And, you know, that's a great discussion point. How do we think about our own lifestyle with some modesty? Because isn't it just so true that what you spend has an awful lot to do with how much you feel like you've got in your pocket? That's certainly what I do, and I feel like I've got lots of money. I just kind of spend it a lot more easily. Well, how do you stop that going out of control? How do you practice contentment? Would be a theme directly from the New Testament, wouldn't it? How do you increase your giving as God gives you more and as you grow? I suppose I want to say out of that that, you know, there's no formula, is there? These are kind of hard questions. And one of the problems is how do you work out the answer? And there's no, for people who like definite answers, there's no definite answer, is there? Because how much is enough to give away? I mean, there is no definite Christian standard of generosity. It's a journey, isn't it? It's going to involve a journey of becoming more like Christ. And if you think about that, it's going to be impossible to outgive someone who set a sacrificial, self-giving example for us. That will always extend us. And of course, as soon as you start to think about this, you'll think about lots of the other material that in the New Testament about the difficulties and temptations in wealth. I've noted down a few. You might think of some others. It's so easy, isn't it, to use wealth as our security. I find myself checking my superannuation balance and the increase in the price or decrease in the price of various assets and shares that I own in order to feel good about myself. And I'm sure that you've never fallen into that kind of temptation. It's just me that suffers from that kind of temptation. I often feel like I have so much wealth that I could buy my way out of just about anything. I'm sure you never tempted to think like that, to think that, well, if you have a problem in life, you'll be able to throw money at it. And then we face the problem of not really having anyone to talk to, honestly, about all of this, except perhaps to God. And that's a tricky discussion. But having a serious discussion about wealth, I mean, this is a great night. I'm really, really, if you're not excited, well, you're probably excited about tonight by being here, but because you've come, I'm really excited that we're having this kind of discussion because wealth is a kind of taboo subject in church. I mean, try asking someone over coffee after church how much they earn. Have you ever tried that? I'm not sure they're going to give you an answer. It's a bit of a taboo subject in Australia in general, but we're cynical and critical of wealth and often justifiably so, but it's hard to have a decent conversation about at church. And some of that is because our situations are really different, isn't it? And it, you know, if I tell you a little story about practically what my wife and I do, which I will in a minute, you've got to hedge it round with lots of provisos. You've got to get the sense that this is just my story, and I don't mean it to necessarily be applicable to you because I don't know everything about your circumstances. But at the same time, when you do know things about people's circumstances, you share that with each other, how do you have a good conversation about that? And as Andrew said in the introduction, you're not going to find serious advisors about this, they're never going to say to you, well, you've got too much and you should give some of it away or more of it away, or what's your plan for giving it away? Kathy and I went to see our financial planner and said exactly that, and he just kind of, his jaw didn't quite drop through the floor, but he just kind of looked at us like we were off another planet. He's a really nice guy. He's not a Christian as far as I know, and he just looked at us like none of my clients have ever come and said to me, we want you to help devise a kind of spreadsheet about how we can give more and more of our wealth away. He just looked at me. He had not a clue. He didn't know what to say. He really didn't. Yeah, I mean, does that resonate with you? Does that ring a bell? How do you find talking about wealth with other people, and where to find people to have this kind of discussion with? I wasn't advising it as the first question when you bowl up to someone. Yeah, g'day. It's really nice to see you at church today. I haven't met you before. And by the way, how much do you earn? There's lots of more basic questions one could start with. Where do you live? How are you? Peers are good, but sometimes they suffer from all the same problems and blind spots as you. So I don't know. What do other people think? Like, I don't have any great wisdom about this. I could count on one hand the number of good conversations about, helpful conversations about money that I've ever had at church. And I've been going to church most Sundays for 30 years. Yeah, lots of different kinds of offerings. So I'm very happy to pin my colours to the mast. I don't believe in tithing. I believe in lots more than that, exactly like Neville said. And the standard in the New Testament, tithing doesn't get a mention. What gets a mention in that most generalised piece of teaching as a standard is being generous and willing to share, to be rich in good deeds. Now, you know, what's generosity mean as a standard? Well, if you follow Jesus, it's a fairly large kind of standard of generosity. So, you know, we're not going to get away with, well, I tithe. Well, actually, I tithe before tax, actually. I'm not sure whether I tithe after tax. You know, you're just not going to get away with, it's not that kind of discussion, is it? And the accountability is not going to be really useful around that kind of discussion, you know. It does remind me of the great Garrison Keillor story about the guy sitting in church one day, and he's not paying much attention during the sermon, and he's writing out a check for the offering that's about to come up. And he hasn't been very well recently, and he manages to write out this check with an extra zero on the end. And he puts it in the offering when the offering is going around. And afterwards, he remembers, he realises what he's done. And conducts this internal monologue about whether one can get up and go and surreptitiously, you know, take it out of the offering bag or whatever. And Garrison Keillor ends the story. He says that Mr. So-and-so, at that moment, Mr. So-and-so had never felt so alive in church before. Yeah, if I was being really honest, I reckon the reason people like it is that the math's easy. I can divide things by 10, and I've got some idea, but I'm not sure. I'm with you that it's a serious obligation there, but the obligation to us is to be generous, which goes way further. Absolutely. So we're going to think in 15 minutes or something, Hayden's going to take over from me and present a model of planning for generosity across a lifetime. Because, of course, we're all at different ages and stages. We have different dependents, people who are dependent on us, and different responsibilities. It makes an absolutely huge difference, and it's really hurtful to not try and understand that about someone else. So, I mean, generosity is a moving standard, isn't it? And quite differently and genuinely differently applicable. But there's still some real questions at the heart of it, and they tend to be ones that I find it easy to kind of squirm out of. And if I have people like Ian suggesting, who I actually openly share, who know me and I share my figures with, I probably get a fairly, if I was prepared to hear it, a fairly honest assessment of, you know, is that how's that going? You know, is going in the right direction? That's just absolutely true, isn't it? You can't start too young about that. My 19-year-old son has a job for the first time in his life and is earning money that is his, that goes into a bank account. He has a bank card and all the rest of it that, you know, goes with it. And I have been, and not he, we have a budget, he has a budget to live at home and to pay me to live at home. Now, that's a great joy as a parent. He's finally paying something back. So we were talking about this the other day. He hasn't paid it yet, you know, so it's coming up to Christmas and we'd given him a lot of grace, you know. We've effectively lent him the money all year. We're not charging interest on it or anything harsh. And just sort of needling him about, is he going to get around to making some payments? And then I thought I'd better say to him, so, you know, when you think about your budget with all this or how you spend it, you know, hopefully you've saved some up to give it back to me for the cost we agreed for you living here. But hopefully you've budgeted to give some to church. So, you know, I start asking him, so, well, you know, how are you thinking about that? You know, I mean, you know, not that he's got a lot, but, you know, how are you thinking about giving? So, you know, I asked him, we had a great conversation about it. What I didn't really want him to do was ask me how I was thinking about giving to church and whether I was giving as much percentage as he was, because he was probably going to give quite a generous percentage out of his small amount. But he's on a pretty good wicket as well. He's got this kind of backstop at home that he doesn't have to pay really. Well, he does have to pay, but he's, you know, he hasn't got any cash flow problems because he hasn't paid yet. But yeah, your point's just entirely right, isn't it? And you can start with younger kids, much younger, giving away. You can divide their pocket money up and you know, give them pockets of money and get them to then give them some money that they're going to give away, so they at least get used to the idea that you can give away. That's what we did anyway. We kind of, you know, divided the kids' money up into three bits. Here are some antidotes to some of the difficulties and temptations of wealth that I mentioned before. These are, I think, really obvious ones, but they're really good. Giving thanks to God for what he's given us. Isn't that a really obvious and great antidote to all the temptations of wealth? You know, you got to think you're not primarily a consumer, you're actually primarily a receiver. You're primarily someone, we're all primarily people who've been given things by God. It's so easy to forget, isn't it? We've been given life. We've been given air to breathe. You know, we have the most wonderful things around us: hot water, people who love us, people who give things to us. There's all the best things in life are free like that, aren't they? I think I find it helpful to dwell on the account we will have to give as God's stewards. So there are lots and lots of stories of Jesus in which his disciples and people on earth are stewards of things that God has given or that a master has given. He goes away, he comes back and he demands an account. And we are obligated to give an account. Now that is a great thing to dwell on, because if we are stewards of the whole creation that God has given us, then we will have to give an account to the master when he returns what we've done with the things that he's given us. And it's all too easy, isn't it, just to sit around and think, no one really saw that. They don't really know. I can kind of appear to be really generous. I can appear like this. I can make myself look okay. That's normal Christian practice, isn't it? That's what you learn to do in the church, kind of after 30 years or 10 years or whatever, isn't it? Learn to fit in and look okay. I can give at some minimal level, but, you know, not be challenged. But to dwell on the account that we'll have to give to God himself, now that's just completely different in terms of motivating us to get serious about thinking about giving and planning to give and planning to be generous. And I've certainly found, thinking about this, that you know, people telling you and to do things is, or yourself telling you to do things is often not very motivating. But God is a great motivator, because there's great joy in giving to what God cares about. And it's just underdone. How many sermons have you heard recently in your church about the joy of giving? I just haven't heard many. I've heard piles of giving. You know, give us more money. We can't pay the minister. Give us, do this. People in the world need it. They're true and good things, but we don't necessarily perhaps get the balance quite right. Jesus said, it's more painful to give than to receive. More blessed to give than to receive. Thank you. People who help others, we know, feel better about themselves. That's because we're becoming like God, isn't it? I mean, we know why people feel better about themselves when they give. It's because they are becoming like God. And God lays causes and people on our hearts, doesn't he? And helping them is actually a joy. You know, it's a great thing to think about. How can you transform your giving? This is not slavery. This is a joyful occupation. This is a family business. God, the Holy Trinity, is into giving. And it's there's enormous joy in giving. And I think we kind of underdo that. Be better to think about that than think about what you have to do. They're my kind of thoughts about antidotes when I feel tempted to kind of ignore this subject or think that I can kind of justify myself where I'm at. Those things have helped me enormously. Let me tell you in the last few minutes that I have, and we might have a few questions and then we're going to swap over. Let me tell you practically what Kathy and I have done with our wealth. Let me hedge that again with what I said before. This is not a story for all of you. This is a story about my wife and I and our situation. And our situation, I suspect, is very different from most people, because we're privileged to be very wealthy, and some of it is inherited and some of it is made. Nevertheless, it all belongs to God. So I'm just going to try and tell you what we've done with it. This might spur some thoughts for you. What we've done is, first is found that planning to give is hard work. You have to swim against the tide, and you really need to be sustained by a contemplation of the treasure in heaven and the joy of giving that, you know, we've thought about just a little bit. And we haven't found many people, because we're fairly wealthy and fairly entrepreneurially wealthy, and those kind of combinations are not that common. They're not uncommon, but they're not that common. We haven't found that many people to talk to helpfully about this, and we're extremely different by temperament. So we have piles of conflict about wealth. I come from a wealthy Jewish entrepreneurial refugee family, and Kathy comes from a very well-educated, professional, social, working, teaching kind of typical Australian background, and they think that money is evil broadly, although they actually had quite a reasonable amount of it. But those two kind of poles are quite a long way apart and have led to very creative conversation over 30 years. And it's taken us about 30 years to come to a common mind about things. What we've done is we've thought, I'll go to sort of more recently what we've done. Recently, one of the things we've done is we thought long and hard about what do our kids need. Because we're getting to an age where they're almost old enough to be thinking about leaving home, and we don't have to pay nearly as much for them. Like I said, my son's now paying me to live at home, oh joy of joys, and if he ever does pay, and pay up, that is. So we've been thinking, well, what do they need? And it's just, you know, the obvious things that you would think of too. What they need from us much more than money is opportunity. So we decided, you know, we're going to give them, we've got piles of resources, we're going to give them piles of opportunity in terms of education, and pray that to those whom much is given, much is expected, and that they'll take up that kind of dictum from our Lord and take it seriously and build it into their lives, so that we might, you know, build children who have the ability to serve others. So we've set aside money for education and maybe for some other experiences, and then we've thought about, well, you know, if we're really wealthy, what do they what else do they really need? Well, we'll probably give them some money to help with housing. And the way we've thought about that is we thought we want them to have to save themselves. We want them to have to work and make money. They're able-bodied. They're not. They don't suffer from any disabilities. My son is cleverer than me. I fully expect that he will earn more money than me at some smarter job that doesn't exist now. In 5 or 10 years' time, he'll be designing the robots that take away your job, and maybe mine. But luckily, some of us will be retired by then. So we want them to have to save, and we want to kind of maybe match that up with something, and they will be in the privileged group of people in Melbourne who probably will be somewhere between 25 and 40 and actually maybe able to afford to buy a house. I heard on the radio that's only 21% of house buyers in Melbourne at the moment are in that category, and that's because they cost about 10 times as much as they used to in kind of real terms, which is all a bit sad. Wages are probably about 2 to 3 times as much as when I bought a house 35 years ago, but the price of the house is 10 times as much, so the real cost is about 3 times. It's 3 times as hard. That's something to think about, and, you know, that gets plenty of airplay on the radio at the moment, doesn't it? So we thought about that, and we did some planning about that, and we set aside some money, and we set aside some money in our minds about that, and then we rewrote our wills in that regard. Now, you know, I'm a lawyer, so I'm going to spruik wills. If you haven't got a will, you should plan to have one. Otherwise, your assets will be given away according to a statutory formula, which might not be what is best in your circumstances for the people who depend on you, nor what is best for God's kingdom or the way you've lived your life. So we can talk about that a bit more afterwards. I've got some things about that, actually, I'll talk about at the very end. So we made a will. Years ago, we set up a family discretionary trust so that when we had excess assets, we could put it into them. We could put them into it. The income that they earn, we can give to our church tax-free, because the income that is earned by a trust and distributed is taxed in the hands of who gets it, not in the hands of the trust. So if you give it to someone who doesn't pay tax, like your church, you can distribute out of your pre-tax earnings. Now, you can't do that with personal earnings, with salary and wages, but if you're fortunate enough to have excess wealth of any sort that earns, assets that earn, you can do that. You can talk to me about that. I'm very happy setting up those kind of arrangements for people so that they can be more generous to tax-free causes in the kingdom of God. We then created a charitable foundation of monies that belong to God. What we've done is tried to work out how much is excess that we have at any one point in time and give it to this foundation. So we want to try and take John Wesley's words seriously. We want to invest all our surplus wealth in actually giving money to God's kingdom, thought of broadly in terms of great causes, Christian mission causes, evangelistic and helpful to others. That's not for everyone, obviously. I mean, you know, you might be feeling sick here now that I'm talking about having excess wealth and you're struggling. But if you've got excess wealth, that's a great structure that is available to you. You can accumulate funds to give away in that kind of structure. You don't pay tax. You don't pay capital gains tax on it, and then you give it away. We found it very helpful to actually give our assets into a structure like that. So we could lend them into that, and then when we needed them, we could have them back. The problem with that is some of the problems that we sort of alluded to before about the temptations of wealth. It helps a lot to have actually dedicated something, to have consecrated something to God's service. That really does help a lot. So we've done that. We've planned through that on increasing our giving. We have a plan to give away all the income and capital of this foundation over 30 years. That's because I'm just about to turn 52, and God willing, we'll still have my marbles with me, I hope, to think about giving responsibly and helpfully maybe at 82, but I have no great hopes after that. And of course, I might not be here at 82. So we have a contingency plan for others who help us as directors of this foundation, that if we snuff it before the 30 years, they're to barrel right on ahead with the plan, and if they want to go faster, they can go faster. What else can I tell you? We've made wills and set aside, as I said, trust funds for our kids with the amount of capital that we think is reasonable to give them. We've decided to only give it to them absolutely when they're 25, on the theory that before that they're not sensible enough to not blow it. So if they die before they're 25, they don't get it. They get maintained until then out of the funds, and they go back to the charitable and Christian mission uses if they die before they're 25. Heaven forbid. It sounds a bit morbid, doesn't it? But, you know, that's why you have lawyers to talk to you about the worst case scenarios in life. There you go. We have given the balance of our assets after providing for children, 20% to our church and 80% to the charitable foundation that I told you about, and we've instructed the directors of the charitable foundation to, as carefully and quickly as possible and prudently as possible, to run out those funds in the same manner that we've got this 30-year plan in place. So, you know, if I am fortunate and blessed enough to live to 82 or plus, we'll have to do a lot of work in terms of working out how to give increasing amounts of money. But, you know, as people say on television, that's a high-quality problem, isn't it, to have. I don't know if those thoughts are helpful to you or just discouraging or encouraging, but I thought it's helpful to try and just lay out something concrete, because I'd asked Andrew to produce someone from St. Alf's to give a helpful couple of stories in different situations, and he declined somehow. I don't know how he got out of that. He said, you'll have to do it. I said, the problem is my story is so idiosyncratic, it won't apply to most people, but there you are. For what it's worth, there it is.
Thank you, John, and thank you, Andrew, for inviting me, and thank you, everyone, for having me. I attend Hills Bible Church in Wanturna. It's a Baptist congregation, and I've been in Melbourne for about 3 years with my family, and probably the story of us moving here is a bit relevant to this topic tonight, so I'll just share that briefly. I had been a Christian for about 6 or 7 years, and living in Canberra, working in the public service, actually at the regulator for the private health insurance sector. And I just had a desire in my heart to start to be doing something a bit more mission focused with my 9-to-5. And yeah, a few different pathways presented themselves to me, and so I started to try and work through what was the best pathway. So pathway one was a very high-paying, nice job was presenting itself. I didn't really think I'd get it, but it was the chief actuary at Medibank. And on the other hand, that wasn't really what I was desiring in my heart, but I had people in my life who were advocating for that path, saying you make a lot of money and you can just give away as much as you want. And it was mainly my dad, in fact, was the advocate for this path. And he was saying, you'll be fulfilling your responsibility to your family. You'll be coming from a position of strength. Therefore, you'll be able to help others. So that was pathway one. Pathway two was I applied to Compassion, to a Christian Child Sponsorship Organisation, to go and work for them in a role that would sort of half utilise my skills, but I thought I could maybe grow into it and see what else I could do there in time. And that was about one quarter of the salary of the Medibank position. And being an actuary, I wanted some kind of framework to evaluate the two paths. Which one is going to have the greater impact for God? Which one is going to have the greater impact on the world? But I found myself clutching at straws. I couldn't evaluate it, and I couldn't work out what would maximise my causes, the things that I cared about. So fast forward a few years, I now run a small consulting company called Causeway, and we consult to organisations and maybe people in the future on strategy. And so businesses have a mission and they want to maximise their mission. And we help them with that. And what I realise, I think even now, is that businesses do that pretty well. It's simple. They know what they want to do and they try and optimise it or maximise it. You think of sports people, they know what their goal is and what's their mission, and they put everything towards maximising it. They're very focused. But as people, we don't really do that, do we? Not many people will be as focused in their sort of mission statement as a business or a sportsman. And I think that's why I struggled with that decision making, and that's why I've come to put together this presentation and given it a few times. And one of my colleagues is here, Jevon, who's helped me with this as well. So thanks, Jevon. So this is a meaningful picture. This is the logo of Causeway. It's the scales of justice, and it's the grey position of the scales is like the before picture. This is what I think is the kind of state of the world. It's scales that are out of balance. So on the one side, the lower side, we have the burdens that people feel, the things that they care about. What is their passion? What is their cause? We're sort of weighed down by those things. We have causes placed on our hearts. Up on the other side is our level of investment into those causes. And I think most people would agree that we feel friction and we feel pain when we think about the things that we care about. And we would say that our level of investment into them doesn't match the burden that we feel inside. So the grey picture is, I would say, the state of the world and the state of many of our hearts. And so, my personal cause has become seeing those scales righted for as many people and organisations as we can. So, what would our world look like if our level of investment in causes was raised to match our level of care? So if we were to live our lives based around what it is that's placed in our heart, what it is that's important or that we care about, then we could say we're doing justice to the place of causes in our hearts. So this is the framework I'm using tonight to work through this in a more practical way. So each of us would answer this question differently. What is it we care about? What am I trying to maximise? What's my cause? For the purposes of tonight, we'll just say we've got two causes. One is the responsibility we feel to provide for our family, call that our internal cause, and that's both a providing now and providing for the future. And the other cause might be to love others, and we'll call that our external cause. So a nice simple framework. Digging a bit deeper, we could say we've got four decisions to make. Now, this is a little 2x2 grid. So the left-hand column represents what we put into our family, providing for the family, and the right-hand column is what we contribute to our external cause. Question one, or decision one, the upper row is what I call the profit and loss. So that just means look at the income we've got coming in and look at the money that's going out. But likewise, we get a certain amount of time each month, each year, that which comes in, and where is our time going? So it's the transactions that are coming in and out all the time. And the balance sheet refers to our assets, our house, our bank balance, etc., plus the soft assets we have, our skills, knowledge, social networks, etc. So question one is trying to manage the tension between our own family P&L and our balance sheet. So at what speed will I build assets to provide for me and my family? So one end of the spectrum, we could spend everything we've got and not build our assets for the future, or the other end of the spectrum, spend almost nothing and be saving and accumulating our assets. Question two manages the tension between in the incomings and outgoings now, so in the P&L, how much will I contribute to my cause, and how much will my external cause, and how much will I contribute to my family? So when will I contribute to my cause, now or later? Question three says, okay, out of what I've decided to contribute to my external cause, what will I contribute, time or money? Which is going to be more optimal? And question four says, okay, I've got all these personal assets. How will I invest them? Is there some way that investing them can actually contribute to the external cause? That's why it's straddling that line. So we'll work through those four questions. Okay. So at what speed will I build assets for me and my family, and when will I contribute to my cause? So I'll just give you three little sort of thought starters on these. The first is the concept of utility curves. I won't go deeply into this, but the basic idea is, for the next dollar that I have, or the next hour that I have, what would be the value that would come if I contributed that to my family? What would be the value that would come from that if I contributed that to my external cause? And I think we can see that when it's the very first dollar, or say it was the only dollar, or the only hour going to our family, that would have a very high value, or a very high utility in our eyes and in God's eyes as we take up that responsibility to provide for our family. Now, the millionth dollar in that year, or the millionth hour, wouldn't have as much value for our family. It would have perhaps very little. But for our external cause, there's not that downward sloping pattern that I just laid out. The millionth dollar or the millionth hour to an external Christian cause is still just as valuable as that first dollar was, because the world is so big. There's so many problems out there to solve, so many people to reach. So that's just an interesting paradigm to think about, and you can think about how that applies to your situation. The second one is, what is the return on investment in our eyes, or God's eyes, of that time or money invested into our family cause versus our external cause? I guess it's much the same concept, but this brings into it brings into our thinking the multiplication. So we might say, yes, that dollar that goes into the external cause is really valuable because it's changing a life. Okay, but the second step is, how is that going to multiply? Because we know how our financial assets multiply. If we leave it in our financial assets, usually that's sort of 5, 6, 7, 8% a year. That's the rate of multiplication. What about if that dollar is invested into a Christian cause and it changes a life, it changes an eternity? How does that multiply? Would that person multiply themselves in their interactions with others at a rate of 5% per annum, or would it be greater than that? I would argue in most cases it would be greater than that. And as they influence all the people around them, and often you see families coming to faith in groups, for example. The third angle is something Andrew mentioned earlier, which, so the first two angles will probably be potentially nudging people towards really thinking a bit harder about the external cause, bringing that to front of mind. And they're working against the influence that we get in many parts of the world. You know, financial planners, super funds, banks will tell you that you need more money. They've got financial incentives to do so, and also risk management incentives to do so. You couple that with our own fears and insecurities, and those of our friends, and that's a pretty powerful combination of messages to really just keep stockpiling. Okay, so this, we're entering into the world of planning across the lifetime, so a lifetime financial plan. So on the vertical axis, we've got our financial assets, and then we've got our age along the bottom. The black line that slopes downwards is what we've called the provide for future line. So the theory is that if you're at that line at a particular age and you know how much you want to be spending for the rest of your life, then more or less you'll be able to run that balance down over your lifetime and be able to provide for your family. Now, of course, there's always lots of uncertainty about this, but just a simplified example. So that's what the black line is. And then I've outlined three possible plans that someone with a heart for their external cause could have. So let's imagine there's three different people and they all have the same heart, but they've just decided to go with different plans. So the orange plan is what I've called the Monopoly plan. So it is a bit like playing a game of Monopoly, where we're trying to accumulate money, we're trying to accumulate property as fast as we can. Nothing's holding us back, we're just going for it, trying to win. That's the orange line. In this example, they reach the provide for future line in their 50s. And then the solid orange line then tracks down the provide for future line after that. So they might keep working and then give their money to their external cause after age 50, or they might even give their time to the external cause after that time. So that their plan was look after myself first and then give back. Now, there's a danger with the Monopoly line, though, which is why I've put the dotted one in. The danger is that, as was talked about before, if you haven't practiced the generosity all the way through, the danger is that you adjust your black line as you're reaching your 50s and you keep going and you think, oh, I actually need to accumulate a bit more, and so you might go up quite a lot higher than what you actually might have planned for otherwise. And if you believe in what I was saying before about the higher return on investment of investing in the external cause sooner, then you've missed out because you've delayed all that investment to too late and it hasn't had a chance to multiply. So I would suggest that that's not the optimal plan. At the other end of the spectrum is the blue line at the running along the bottom, which I've called the give, give, give line. And this one says, this person says, I don't want to accumulate any assets. Anything I get, I'm going to give it away, or I'm only going to work as much as I need to make just enough income to cover my expenses, and the rest of my time I'm going to dedicate to my external cause. So they very deliberately keep their assets low, and they just give everything they have all the way through. And the third one is in between. So this one I've named the responsible maximizer. So the danger of the give, give, give line is we've got these two tensions. One is the provision for a family and the other is the external cause. And the give, give, giver may be running a risk in terms of the providing for family part of that equation. So, and I guess they also would need to be happy with living on the age pension in their older age. So everyone would probably have a different green line, potentially somewhere in between those two, and that would be a very individual thing. So I've basically said if you're able to think about the two lines and what is going to maximise your total sort of cause outcomes, your family cause and your external cause over your lifetime, then maybe there's a green line somewhere in between. Okay, so it's fairly flat at the younger ages because if you had an amount of money, you would only, and it had to last your whole lifetime, you would pretty much just be able to take out the amount of interest that you received, plus only a little bit of the capital. Because if you took too much of the capital, then you'd run your balance down too quickly. So that's why it's flat in the younger ages. As you get older, you can take more and more of your capital as well as the interest, because you've got less years left to survive. So you can start taking your capital. That explains the shape.
So high at 20, because most people don't have any money at 20.
That's right. So
it looks like he's got heaps of cash at 20.
No. So that's a The black line is a theoretical line that if you were at that point, then you wouldn't need to earn an income after that time. But in this example, I've got everyone starting down at zero at age 20. In terms of numbers, no, I won't do that. But some sort of rules of thumb might be when you're 50, 60 years old, if you worked out what yearly income you need for the rest of your life, you could maybe multiply that by 15 to 20, and that might be your provide for the future line. And it would be a smaller number as you get older. Now, that only had the... that was only looking at the... my family side of things, and I've done this grid to bring the external causes into the picture as well. So this is the Monopoly plan. Basically it says it's really rich in colour for my family in the P&L in the early times. That just means the P&L is very healthy, so much more income than expenditure. We're putting money away in our early years. So as we move through that, the six sections of the My Family P&L, that's six different age groups basically through our life. So it's very healthy up to retirement, and then after retirement we're not making any money anymore, so it goes to white. So black is healthy and white is not so healthy. And the balance sheet builds up from nothing at the start through to very healthy at the end. That's the white, grey through to black. External cause, we do nothing while we're working for our external cause, and then later we contribute a lot to our external cause. And the balance sheet of the external cause doesn't really get built up by what we're doing very much. maybe because we have supported that cause that has helped it to grow a bit over time. So there's some contribution there. The give life grid. Our P&L is never healthy. It's always just in balance, and we don't accumulate any balance sheet for ourselves and our family. We put everything we've got into the external cause, which looks great for the external cause's P&L, and it contributes to building up that external cause and its assets over time. The responsible maximises somewhere in between. So the our P&L starts off sort of even, and over time it gets more and more healthy, as does our balance sheet. And we contribute something into our external cause right from the beginning, and then more in the later years. So if we can find ways to push our curve or our speed that we accumulate our assets to the right, if we can find a way that we're satisfied with to accumulate our personal assets more slowly, then that would mean that we're able to contribute more to the cause sooner, which, if that returns and multiplies, is a good thing to do. So what would be some strategies or ways of doing that? So the first way is just thinking about these principles. I've said improving the kind of literacy with these ideas and actually doing some planning. Insurance is a useful one, because one of the reasons we often accumulate is for the fear of the bad event that goes wrong. And so if we can have insurance in place to cover some of those fears of the bad event, then that can perhaps slow down our rate of asset accumulation. Now, take a deep breath on number three. This is very countercultural, but I've said renting a house as opposed to owning a house, and particularly at certain ages. So for the young person, if you think about if they were to rent, they've got small steady cash flows going out to the rental payments through their 20s and 30s, and no capital tied up. But if they buy a house, they've got the capital tied up from at least the deposit and more as they pay into it. And bigger cash flows generally as well. So the purchase of a house restricts the possibility to invest into the external cause. And of course, it brings benefits owning the house, which is why people do it. Of course, despite the cost. It brings security to the family, which is a good thing. And so what I actually would love to see here is a solution that did both things. If you could have a solution that gave security and stability to your family whilst also having the lower cash flows, therefore giving you more flexibility with your finances and your time, that would be an optimal solution. So that would look like some kind of long-term stable renting possibility, perhaps where you connect these people who want to be long-term renters with investors who want to invest in property. So that's one idea. And there's a similar concept for older ages. Wouldn't it be great if people at older ages who actually wished to use up some of their housing capital could do so? I guess people are doing that through things like reverse mortgages. But what if you could sell your house into this housing trust, that where the housing trust would give you guaranteed rental of it for the rest of your life, thereby freeing up that capital to use for your external cause or for your family cause as well. Building soft assets is just an idea that if you have more skills, experience, relationships, then it's like another form of insurance. If something goes wrong in your life, you've got more there to fall back on. So you can afford to have less financial assets if you're strong in soft assets. The last one, this is sort of intended for younger people who really have a heart to actually go and do some work in a sort of a Christian cause setting. But the salary isn't there. There's no possibility of it. So this idea is connecting people like that with Christian investors who are willing to might be willing to fund their salary to if they really believe in the work that this person wants to do.
I guess what I'm saying is that cost of living is like I was just seeing on the news tonight that the median house price in Melbourne's at $780,000. It's grown 10% in the last 12 months. It's the highest growth rate in the country. I'm trying to work out how do people plan for the future when you've got, in my what I'm seeing is probably the my generation, the, from when I first bought our house 20 years ago, I think the last 20 years the market's changed considerably. And I'm trying to work out where's the sustainability in the model that you've got there, knowing that provide for future line is a very rubbery line, isn't it? With, yes. You know, cost of aged care, we're moving into, our ageing population, that's just going to increase at a great rate of knots just through just demand and supply. Mm. If you have a look at the housing market in Australia, if they're going to say Melbourne's at 8 million people in the next 30 years, that's double what we've got now. Property prices aren't dropping. They are going to go through the roof. And even when you talk about renting, there's a supply issue there too. So, and what I will say there is that that's also the market talking to us. So what we're talking about here is actually rather countercultural. You know, what John, you're talking about giving and, you know, people aren't like that. You know, most people are trying to look wealthy and they're borrowing at unbelievable rates to do that, to actually look like I'm earning a lot. You know, you can have a conversation with someone after church and I'm looking at it going, how do you afford to do what you're doing? So what I'm probably saying is that provide for future line, oh, Andrew asked the question, what is that figure? You know, and if it's 50 grand multiplied by 20 and you've got your figure, I'm trying to work out how do you know that? Because I actually think things have changed a lot in the last sort of 20, 25 years.
Yeah, well, that's exactly why I didn't want too much emphasis to be on the figure, but more on the framework. But I think the most important thing there is how do we manage that uncertainty? So you brought up about three or four sort of areas of uncertainty, which mean that if we're at that line, we're actually maybe only 50% confident that we've got enough. So should we push up the line until we're 90% confident or 95 or 99? How do we manage that uncertainty? That's the real challenge. So we have to trade that off against... So how much is getting 5% more certainty that we've got enough worth to us? How much is that worth in our eyes, in God's eyes, compared to that investing in that external cause now? But then I think it would be sensible to think about, are there ways that we can manage this uncertainty? So, for example, converting your retirement savings into a pension is one way of managing uncertainty. Maintaining skills so that perhaps you could find some work if you needed to is another way. Various forms of insurance are a way. Strong relationships, as I mentioned, is, you know, a lot of countries and people in the world effectively draw on their relational pension as they get older. It's something that's happening less perhaps in our society. And of course, then the willingness of potentially, yes, you might have to trade off some future income. You'll never be certain of it. And what would my life look like if I had 10% less due to some shock or some uncertainty? It's a difficult question. It's certainly not as simple as it looks on this graph. Lots of uncertainty. But the trouble is if we focus on that uncertainty and getting ourselves in a totally sure position, I think we're losing something. We're not actually going to get the optimal outcome. Yes, I love that question. That's great. I think how I would fit that into this framework is that Perhaps a person that is either willing to live on less or maybe has more trust in God's provision is probably going to have a lower line, and they're going to be closer to that give line than others. And I think that's an important thing to consider for each of us. Yeah, I think looking at this graph, we can get... I guess that perspective would say... we don't have the external cause side up there, but we could be that's talking about the balance between investing in our family and our cause. And I think the other interesting thing to think about on this graph is to plot where I am right now. So look at your age, you'd have to think about what your provide for the future line is, but am I, and where would my green line be? What would be a satisfactory sort of trajectory, and am I above or below it? If depending on where you are, it might have significant implications on where you would, what the rest of your plan might look like. Let me skip over that one. That's just it's interesting that this was my decision earlier. Do I go and work for Compassion and basically contribute my time, or do I go and work for a private health insurer and contribute my money? And for me, the biggest factor was I felt that the impact of the time giving was going to be worth more and multiply more and had greater potential than the money giving. And I also thought that the kind of personal inspiration that it would give me would be very valuable as well to me and my family and my walk with God. Okay, this is taking it one step further. So imagine we've worked out that we wanted sort of roughly the green line, but we used one or two of those strategies I mentioned to push it even further to the right, and we had the purple line. Now the question is, so we've got some personal assets sitting there. Say we're at age 60 and they're the size of that purple column. Is there anything I can do with them? So they might be sitting in shares or bank accounts or a house, etc. The question is, so when your money is in shares, two things happen. A benefit comes out two ways. So a benefit comes out to you through the return on that share, the capital appreciation and the dividend. If you've got your money in a term deposit at a bank, that you get the interest. But something also happens on the other side. So you've just provided the bank with capital, whether it's shares or a term deposit, and that capital helps the bank grow its business. It goes and lends the money. It's now bigger and stronger, and it's just grown its business. So sometimes we don't think about the other side of that investment and what it's done. So the question is, could we put our money into a place where, yes, we get some return back, and the other side, the growth in the business or the cause that we've just put the money in allows that cause to grow. And perhaps it's a cause that's in line with our external cause. So this is sort of, this is the concept of social impact investment that some of you might have heard of that's been growing. So how to have an investment that creates a financial return and a social impact at the same time. So the idea is, could some of my assets be parked in my external cause? So let's say my cause is some overseas mission that needs properties in order to function. Could I, along with a group of others, become a property investor? Yes, we get a return back from them. They pay some rent to this property trust. But that is a lot, because they've had that that capital, that property funded for them, when their donations come in from their donors, those donations can go to the field after they've covered the rental payments. So more gets invested in the mission sooner. So there's potentially a large impact from that kind of investment. And likewise, we all have various soft assets. Maybe if you're an actuary like me, you might have some spreadsheets or some models that could help your external cause, or some experience, or social networks, or etc. And so we also have these soft assets, and can they be parked in the cause, or given or borrowed by the cause? So I've called that the creative responsible maximizer, someone who's also doing something with their assets, and it basically just builds the external causes balance sheet faster. It hasn't turned out quite right, but so far I've talked totally from the individual's perspective about how an individual could plan their finances and their giving. But along the way, I hinted at some sort of systems that might help facilitate or boost that process. And so this is the final slide. So the first sort of system that could help facilitate, you know, this kind of causeway thinking and drive more investment into causes sooner, it's around this financial planning and understanding these concepts. So that's something that I'm hoping to do in my company over the coming years, is to build a financial planning business based around these principles. So the core principle would be, how do we maximize your causes across your lifetime? And we build our financial planning models around that. The second one I mentioned before is matching up someone who wants to do some kind of Christian work, maybe entrepreneurial, with someone who is willing to provide that salary. I also mentioned the residential property trust, matching up the people who want to be long-term renters with people who want to be property investors. I haven't mentioned the fourth one. Oh, yes, I have. Yep, the fourth one is what I just mentioned about, you know, for example, the overseas mission who needs property, and they can avoid having to invest in capital if it's funded by others. And the fourth one is, I mentioned the soft assets that we have as individuals. There's lots of these soft assets that our external causes would find very valuable. Maybe we need a matching service for that to match us up with where the needs are. But also, I think there's great room for creating an inventory of soft assets that different not-for-profits and charities and missions have that they'd be willing to share with others, with the needs of other similar organisations. So those are some of the things that that our company is interested in sort of seeding, because we can see the leverage that they might create. Yeah, powerful was the exact word I was going to use. So you're right, I only hinted around the edges of that concept when I talked about soft assets and relationships and how they could help help us manage the uncertainty, help us not need to accumulate as much as individuals. But there would be amazing power if we had communities in action finding a way to pool or share finances and really looking after those who are struggling. That would be, I would say, more powerful than any of the other concepts we've mentioned tonight, in terms of avoiding the need to just accumulate due to our individual circumstances and insecurities and trying to manage our own uncertainty just by ourselves. Yes, if you look at the kind of community in ACTS for example, where they shared everything, then you would greatly increase the investment in the external causes. Yeah, I have thought that through, and I'll give you the very high level view for now, because it would take a long time to give you all the details. And I'm sure a lot of my ideas might not work practically as well. But so for the residential property trust, we have the property investors on the one side that we're matching up to the long-term renters on the other side. The long-term renters would get a guarantee that they will never get kicked out of their property. That's the big advantage for them. And they'll be paying market rent, and so the investors will get a normal market return. It needs someone in the middle to manage all the details. It needs a property manager and a financial manager and all of that. The social cause property trust is similar. I should say one big issue might be liquidity for the investors, and so that would be another risk to be managed. And same thing for the social cause property trust. Should be a market-based return for the investors. If they really believe in that cause, they're free to donate some of that return back. But let's separate out those issues. And the cause or the not-for-profit or charity would just be paying rent to that that trust. And the big benefit they get is the long-term stability again. They have the assurance that they won't be kicked out.
That's a great question. I mean, I don't think there's any really easy answer. I think some of the things you mentioned are really good. So in small groups, it's a good discussion. So having some good, just very basic material about Christian giving available, and, you know, that's written by some people in your church and available to be used, and encouraging groups to use it, that'd be a great start. I'm not sure. Other people probably have some really good ideas, because it's a kind of... We often hesitate to have sermons on really basic things. We think, oh, everyone's heard that. But it's a bit like the kids' talk, isn't it? It's often the best part of church, because the sermon's really boring and I just fall asleep. But I got the point in the kids' talk. So maybe we should have more basic sermons. Maybe, you know, once a year, once every 2 years, your church should be talking about money. Yeah, but other people have great ideas about that, I'm sure. I don't have any huge wisdom about it.
Right, thank you so much, John and Hayden. I think that brings us to the close of our evening. It's 9:45. I want to thank both these guys. I want to thank Hayden especially, because he was really unwell. And he's come along tonight and presented, and I know that he probably would prefer to be at home in bed. So thank you so much to both of you. Thanks for, opening our eyes some more to some of the complexities, and I think encouraging us to be good stewards and good students of stewardship and to think this stuff through. One of the things I've taken away from tonight is thinking about that balance between providing for my family and thinking about, you know, giving all the things that my children need as they grow up, but also thinking about having that cause and how I invest in that and where those curves kind of are. There's been some really good comments from the group, and I thank you for those comments. I think one of the things I wrestled with coming to tonight was even the question of, is this a godly question to ask? You know, shouldn't we just trust God to give us what we need, and shouldn't we just serve him without asking all these questions? And I think, we need to be really considered Christians, don't we, and to think this stuff through. And so lots of challenges. I really like what you said, Tim, about, you know, life is full of extra things that we somehow think are necessary and aren't really. And so maybe there's challenges there around our own personal budgeting and what's in our budget that we actually don't really need. And even, do you have a budget? So lots of great things. And thank you for sharing your experiences, some of the challenges that you guys have faced as you've gone through making financial decisions. So please feel free to take some literature from John. These guys will be around for a few minutes if you want to ask a personal question. Hayden, are you happy for us to put this PowerPoint onto our website as something that people can download in the next week or two? Yep. So if you'd like to look at that document again, maybe look at some of those graphs again after tonight's session, it'll go up onto our website for a couple of weeks and you can go there and download it as a PDF, I think. Thank you so much for coming out tonight. I hope it's been useful. I want to encourage you. One of the very first questions John raised was that it's so hard to talk about money. And I want to encourage you to talk about money. And it was one of the things I wrote down in my notes, was just, you know, how do we even have this conversation when we have this cultural milieu that says you don't talk about money? Nothing too detailed anyway. And so as I take up Ian's challenge, find a friend, a colleague, a mentor who you can say, listen, this is what I earn. This is what I've got invested. This is what I'm planning to do with it. Do you think I'm being faithful? And have some really tough conversations rather than keep it all kind of secret and just between you and God. And as John said, that's a hard enough conversation as it is. So thank you so much for coming tonight. God bless you as you wrestle with those challenges and questions. And please keep talking to each other. Why don't I just finish with a very quick word of prayer and we'll go. Father, we just thank you for this evening. Thank you for the fact that you have put us in a society that is wealthy and that you have given many of us in this room many resources, and we're challenged as to how we can use them. We thank you that you tell us that to those whom much has been given, much will be expected, and we pray that we will not fail you in that, and that we will be able to give a good account when we stand before you. And Lord, I just pray that you would give us wisdom, give us humility, help us to be sacrificial and generous in the way that we give. We pray too for Hayden and John. We pray you would bless their work and their ministry, and bless them as they challenge people to think very carefully about their use of money and how they give it away. We pray these things now and ask your blessing on us as we go home. In Jesus' name, amen.